Okay. Thank you very much, Roman. And well, actually, you talk about very precise calculations, which are thought for very precise measurements. And since I'm a quantum chemist, so I will try to talk about first principle calculations and to show you what are the limits of nowadays electronic structure theory. Okay, so I'd like to start with this quotation from Ted Hensch, from his Nobel lecture, which was entitled Patient for Precision. And he says that in our highly complex and ever-changing world, it is reassuring to know that certain physical quantities can be measured and predicted with very high precision. And then precision measurements has always appealed to me as one of the most beautiful aspects of physics. With better measuring tools, one can look where no one has looked before. More than once, seemingly minute differences between measurement and theory have led to major advances in fundamental knowledge. The birth of modern science itself is intimately linked to the art of accurate measurements, and I have added that also precision calculations. Because the measurement itself is nothing. One has to understand what has been measured, and for this we need a theoretical model. Okay, so here's the plan of my talk. So I'll start with a little motivation, showing you what is interesting from my point of view. Then I will introduce the state-of-the-art present-day theoretical model that can be used in very precise calculations. What are the challenges for both theoreticians and experimentalists? And then I will go to some examples. One of the key examples from the University of Warsaw is, of course, the hydrogen molecule, which is worked out in this laboratory for 6 years. And also the scattering length of H2. Then I have some preliminary results for this A triplet sigma U state of lithium. And together with Christiane Koch, we work quite intensively on the A plus C manifold of the strontium dimer, just to assist the experiments of Tania Żelewiński. Okay, so what is the theoretical motivation for this kind of research? So the first motivation is to look at the present-day predictive power of the quantum theory. And by quantum theory, I don't mean just electronic structure theory and CCSD or CCSD parenthesis D or something like this, but really, what can we get in the limit of the non-relativistic theory? Then how to go beyond the Schrödinger model, how to go beyond the Wright-Pauli approximation, and so on and so forth. So I will show you how far we are and how accurate we are. And then I will move to some open questions in molecular physics which are not solved yet, or very little is known about this. So one is the molecular Gerade and Gerade mixing. And I would like to stress one thing. I do not use in my talk any semi-empirical spectroscopic Hamiltonian, okay? So all the models are based on some fundamental equations and do not have any ad hoc parameters, at least until some stage. So this is one thing. Then finite nuclear size corrections, which should show up in the spectra, and we know what is the Hamiltonian for it. Actually, nowadays people work very hard to know what is the diameter of the proton, and atomic spectroscopy is contributing a lot to this problem. And one can imagine that also molecular spectroscopy could get some information about this. Then I think we understand very well quantum electrodynamics at the alpha cube level, where alpha is defined structure constant, but we know nothing about alpha to the fourth, and I will show you some experimental results which are very close to the level where alpha to the fourth should be included. And if, Frederick Merkt will keep his promise, then we'll have to do alpha to the fourth and recoil corrections and quite a lot. Well, next point, which was not seen in the experiments, is the QED retardation in the long range. Actually, you know that there was a famous paper by Casimir and Polder in 1948, which shows that the actual potential in the long range is not R to minus 6, but if we go to sufficiently large distances, the power law changes to R to minus 7, and he explained this change in the power law by the fact that the interactions go through the exchange of virtual protons. But if you take the long-range interactions in the excited states, there are new retardation mechanisms that start to play the game, and actually there are some retardation effects which are due to the exchange of real photons, and the power law changes even more drastically. The question is whether the spectroscopists can observe levels close to some specific dissociation with sufficient precision. Okay, and then, well, this is just last year, there was two papers appeared that claimed that there are strong nuclear interactions that are like van der Waals interactions, so they show R to minus 6 attraction. And actually, if you guys are able to measure so precisely the levels, just to be sure that the discrepancy between theory and experiment is due to long-range nuclear forces, that's highly welcome. Well, this is a bit speculative, but the paper appeared in Annals of Physics, which is a decent journal in physics. So they have some estimates of this nuclear C6. So a very precise measurement is highly welcome.
But Robert, I mean, actually this goes all the way to Ramsey. Okay, so, but I don't know if these specific forces conserve parity or time reversal, but Ramsey, in fact, has looked at some exotic forces inside of molecules.
Yeah, I must say that I don't understand much of these papers because they are based on quantum chromodynamics and I think I understand more or less QED, but step further, no. I found them speculative, but. Anyhow, some proposals like this exist, and of course, if somebody can prove that such a force exists, this is definitely molecular spectroscopy.
So this will be van der Waals?
Yeah, this will be van der Waals, but
van der Waals length?
No, and actually, I wanted to give you the reference, but I couldn't find it. Okay, and then of course the nice proposals from the molecular physics side is to look how to go beyond the standard model, and actually I had the opportunity to visit CERN last year and they showed me all these experiments and the super collider and the results. Actually, they are not very happy to discover this Higgs boson, just because, you know, there will be a huge cutting of funds on high energy physics. So now they say that, we have some resonance, but it's not sure whether this is Higgs boson or not. But, actually, they didn't like that when I told them that with molecular spectroscopy and with, a million of euro, we can make very precise experiments. They can lead to some physics beyond the standard model. they didn't like, but it's true that that we can, and actually the four subjects that I mentioned here are being pursued in the laboratories, and one is the time variation of the electron to proton mass ratio, and we try to help Tania Żelewiński as far as we can. There was a proposal by, how to measure the time variation of the fine structure constant. Well, we heard about the electron dipole moments a few weeks ago, and theory assisted a lot in the measurements of the mass of the neutrino. So, but actually I will not, I will just talk about the strontium experiment. I will not cover the other topics. Okay, and of course I have to mention this name because this gentleman, Włodzimierz Kołos, was the founder of the Polish quantum chemistry, and actually he was the supervisor of my master thesis. And well, this this picture was taken when he was postdoc at the University of Chicago in the laboratory of Robert Mulliken in 1953. And in this year, he did his first calculations on the hydrogen molecule. Actually, he had to diagonalize, well, the size of the basis set was 50 functions, including explicitly inter-electronic distance in the basis. And he had a computer with 4 kilobytes of memory. Still, he managed to construct the Hamiltonian matrix 50 by 50, the overlap matrix, because the basis is not orthogonal, 50 by 50, and solve the generalized eigenvalue problem and get the energy. But, well, this is, of course, one side of the story, but the nicest side of the story is that Kołos and his former PhD student Wolniewicz got the most precise results for the dissociation energy of the hydrogen molecule. And it happened so that theory was lower than the experimental results of Hertzberg. And this was in contradiction with the variational principle. So then, of course, people started to think, what's going on? Who is wrong? Of course, Hertzberg was a big shot, and nobody could say that Hertzberg is wrong, but, well, the Polish guy, who knows. So actually they repeated the calculations with the quadruple precision. Well, they checked everything they could check, and in 1968 they published a PRL paper that, well, they confirmed the results that they got. Then Hertzberg invited Kołos to Canada. Well, they had a long discussion, and then the collaborators of Hertzberg noticed that Kołos got twice a glass of sherry. And apparently at Hertzberg's home, getting one glass of sherry was the standard, but the second was much beyond the standard. And then Hertzberg decided to reconsider the experiment. And actually, it turned out that the experiment was wrong, not the theory. And the new experimental value, the theoretical value, was just in the middle of the error bounds, of the new experimental error bounds. And in this way, Kołos was cited, very widely cited, in the Nobel lecture of Hertzberg, and how he became internationally recognized. But you understand that, well, having a master director like this, a lot of us are still interested in high precision quantum chemistry. And let us start from the beginning. So the simplest model that we can think of is the Schrödinger-Coulomb equation. And this is something that all of you know. This is a beautiful model. We have just kinetic energy of the particles, Coulomb interaction between the particles, linear equations with very little parameters. We have only the masses and the charges that are parameters. So the only two kinds of material parameters. Beautiful equation, mathematically very well understood, because this is a self-adjoint operator. We have this is an eigenvalue problem. We know from the mathematical point of view, we know everything about this equation. Just to tell you that a mathematical proof that Hartree-Fock equations have solutions appeared only in the 1980s, just because the Hartree-Fock equations are nonlinear. We solved these equations since 1950s, and we know for sure that they have solutions, and they have very good solutions. But from the mathematical point of view, it was so complex to prove it that, well, the proof was published in 86. Well, the fact that this equation has decent solutions, that it's physical, this is known since 19th century, no problem. But, well, this equation is crucial for chemists, just because it has an enormous predictive power, and of course we have to introduce some approximations to solve it, but still for chemists, you know, we get perfect photochemistry of organic molecules. Well, raw vibrational spectra, not high resolution spectra, but in the harmonic approximation, this is what organic chemists need for millions of molecules. We get NMR parameters for thousands and thousands of molecules. We get rates of chemical reactions, barrier mechanism of reactions. So our chemistry can be based on this equation. So this is beautiful. So this is a very useful equation. But that's not only this, because we can use this equation as the first step to construct, well, a perturbation theory intuition of the fine and hyperfine and possibly quantum electrodynamics effects into the theory in a hopefully systematic way. You will see that it's not systematic.
Isn't this equation that Dirac had in mind when he made his derogatory statement
about
the chemistry being solved?
Yeah. Yeah, precisely. This is what Dirac said, that this equation covers all chemistry and large parts of physics. He said large parts of physics and the whole chemistry. Okay, so let's have a look on this example of hydrogen molecule, how this Schrödinger-Coulomb theory works. So actually, probably you know that in chemistry we use the adiabatic separation of the electronic and nuclear motions. So first we have the Born-Oppenheimer energy, which is this number.
So each molecule is that?
H2, yeah.
Is this in wave numbers?
Yeah, that's in wave numbers. Of course, I will only use wave numbers. Then we have mass correction, which is diagonal mass corrections. That's five wave numbers. So then we have the coupling between electronic and nuclear motions, so which we call non-adiabatic corrections. That's 0.4. So the total non-relativistic, so the total Schrödinger-Coulomb is this number. And the most recent experiment is this. So you see that the missing effect is 0.7 wave numbers. So you see that from the point of view of a chemist, 0.7 over 36,000, that's nothing. I mean, even 5 over 36,000, that's nothing. So this number for a chemist is a perfect number. So the Born-Oppenheimer approximation is perfectly sufficient to describe molecules in non-resolved experiments. Okay?
What value did Coase get actually for the Born-Oppenheimer energy?
Oh, it was this 0.5 something. Uh-huh. So.
But he did also calculate the adiabatic correction.
Yeah, but well, I am quoting the newest results because I refer to the newest experiment. So I want to show you.
I was saying that I remember reading Coase's papers that did include the adiabatic correction.
Yes, that's correct. But still, everything was recomputed, and each time the new experiment comes out, new calculations are done, and because you know people are pushing you know this uncertainty to further and further digits, and Frederick Merck promised us to make this. You know, not 10 to the minus 5, but 10 to the minus 8.
So so the theoretical error bar is just the basis situation?
This is fairly technical, but it was quite rigorously analyzed. So we can trust these error bars. Okay, so then we are missing the relativistic correction. So this is this 0.7 wave numbers, and how to do it. So one way, we know that the hydrogen atom is well described by the Dirac Hamiltonian. So let's do the following. Let's replace the one electron part of the Schrödinger equation by the Dirac Hamiltonian, and add up to this the electron repulsion. And this is what we call the Dirac-Coulomb Hamiltonian, and it is widely used in the relativistic quantum chemistry, and there is a Dirac program which is developed in Toulouse by Tronsauer. It's also developed together with some people in Aarhus, with some Germans that I forgot, but it will come back. So there is a huge collaboration in Europe, and they developed the program, which is called Dirac, and which is based on the Dirac-Coulomb Hamiltonian. But, this Hamiltonian is rejected by many physicists, and there must be good reasons why is it so. So, and this Hamiltonian has many very serious problems. First of all, it has only a continuous spectrum from minus infinity to plus infinity with no bound states. So there's no lower bound on the energy. So the larger the basis you put in your wave function, the lower the energy you get. So, then one more thing. This was discovered by Pestka from Turing and some other guys, that the physical states are not bound states, but are Feshbach resonances. And actually, even the ground state has a non-physical width, which is proportional to the cube of the fine structure constant. So this, we don't like too much. The resonances, that's already physical resonances, that's already tricky. But if you have n physical resonance, that's even worse. But that's the life. I mean, this is mathematics. Okay, what we have more? So the ground state is unstable and has a finite lifetime. Well, actually, one could try to eliminate by using some Feshbach projection. But those who know the theory of Feshbach resonances, they know that the definition of the projection operators in the Feshbach theory is very tricky. And I had the story that even Feshbach didn't know how to rigorously define the projection operator for some specific problem. And actually, one of such projections was suggested by Sacher. It's not unique and doesn't solve the problem. Then we have the wrong mass correction, wrong mass dependence. Yeah?
Is this equation Lorentz invariant?
No. No, it's Lorentz invariant only for the hydrogen atom.
Is there a many body Dirac?
No. No. And I can tell you the story that probably the most famous quantum chemist who could have got Nobel Prize was Clemens Rutan. So this was the guy who introduced the finite basis set expansion into the quantum chemistry and introduced the self-consistent field theory. So he was on, and you know, starting from Rutan's work in 51 and 53, quantum calculations on water molecule, and you may have a look at JCP of that time, and you have molecular orbital calculations on H2O, molecular orbital calculations on NH3, etc. So, and this was by Pope, who got the Nobel Prize, and some other guys. But all this was thanks to Rutan. But Rutan was an obstinate guy, and he decided that he will create a Lorentz invariant many electron theory. And he spent quite a lot of his life on doing this and getting nothing. Finally, he was fired from the University of Chicago. He got a position at Hewlett-Packard, and he works as a programmer. And last time that I saw him, he showed me how to compute the logarithm of 2 with an infinite precision and how to get the 3J symbols with also infinite precision. He's very, very old, very, very lively, but...
Why was he fired?
Just because he didn't have any scientific results. So it's better, you know, to choose the scientific goals that may have expected solutions in a finite time. Okay, and well, there are a few more problems with this equation which I mentioned, and this sentence that became historical. Actually, you are a physicist, so you don't know probably Werner Kutelnik, but Werner Kutelnik is one of the Herr Professor from Germany. He's the most famous quantum chemist, German quantum chemist. He made a lot of developments in quantum chemistry. Now I'm sure that he's skiing in Maria Afar, because there is another workshop which started on Monday, so Kutelnik is there. And he thought that Dirac Coulomb equation is a mathematical and physical nonsense. And well, in a sense, when you look at the number of problems that the Dirac Coulomb model has, one could say that he's right. But on the other hand, well, this equation is mostly used by chemists. And you know, chemists, they know how to play with basis sets and things like this. And actually, chemists developed so-called balanced basis sets, which somehow stabilize the energy of the Dirac-Coulomb Hamiltonian. And moreover, if you compare the results with the experiment, they are good. And from the chemist's point of view, this is sufficient in a sense. So chemists do not care about all the mathematical subtleties of the theory, but they rather aim to get results. But the most important point is that physicists do not have any decent proposal. So there is nothing from the physics side that...
Well, I mean, there are, right? I mean, people do these computations with the Dirac equation and work on some other problem, right? But basically, I mean, in practice, we just introduce the projection operators and project out all the negative energy states, the ERC. Basically, this solves the problem. I mean, it may, this procedure does depend on the basis, but in practical terms, I mean, the dependence is not that strong. And
we
could discuss later on, I mean, why it's not.
I am not against the Dirac-Coulomb equation. Actually, I don't use it, but I only show you what are the mathematical problems with this model. But now, of course, as I said, a lot of people made some very, very useful applications, and a lot of chemists doing calculations of very heavy systems use this this approach. Okay, but I will talk about light systems. And so actually, I will try to convince you that the Dirac equation is not necessary, fortunately. And what we can do is the so-called bound state quantum electrodynamics. Well, which is not free from some mathematical problems. Actually, mathematically, it's more subtle than the Dirac-Coulomb theory. But finally, even if we get divergent integrals, we somehow know how to regularize things to get the finite result. And it happens so that this final result makes sense. So that's good. Okay, so the QED Hamiltonian basically has two terms. One is the Hamiltonian for the photons. Second one is the Hamiltonian for the electrons and positrons. And then we have the interaction term. Well, I will not talk about, because this theory is just awful. You know, when you try to make an order by order, so when you try to derive alpha square, alpha cube, and so on, at each power of alpha you encounter only divergent diagram integrals coming from some Feynman diagrams, and you have to be a very good expert to know how to combine term by term to get rid of the singularities and get the final results. But finally, there are a few experts in the world who do it, and up to the alpha cube terms, this theory is well accepted by the physical community. So this is what we get in the non-relativistic QED. So we expand the energy, and we get the non-relativistic energy, which comes from the Schrödinger equation. Then we get alpha square terms, which are relativistic corrections. This is the first QED that starts to play the game at alpha cube level. Then we have alpha to the fourth, and so on. Most probably the series are divergent. So anyhow, we have to stop somewhere here or there, but certainly no convergence of this series. But let's discuss this term, because this is the relativistic term, and some of you may be familiar. And this is nothing else than the expectation value of the Bright-Pauli Hamiltonian. And this Bright-Pauli Hamiltonian contains a few terms that some of you may know. This is the mass velocity. This is the momentum to the power of 4. And already this operator is very singular, so you may imagine that some others are even more singular. Then we have the Darwin, one electron Darwin. This is a delta function, so that's also not a nice operator, and one has to regularize it to make the theory properly formulated. Then we have the two electron Darwin term, which is the Darwin electron-electron. Then we have the orbit-orbit interaction. This is, in other words, the Bright interaction. Then we have this full spin-orbit interaction, which contains a one-electron spin-orbit, spin-orbit, and spin-other-orbit terms. Then we have spin-spin, and then we have hyperfine, which I do not mention here. So this is what we get. What we get at the order of alpha square, and well, some terms are not included in this equation because there is no coupling between the electronic and nuclear degrees of freedom. Okay, and these terms are called recoil corrections, and they are proportional to the ratio of electron to proton mass in the power some power n. So they are hopefully, since they are already alpha square, so alpha square is 10 to the minus 4 divided by 1,000, so that's 10 to the minus 7. So hopefully these recoil corrections will not be important. Nobody computed them for any molecule. Okay. So then, of course, the interaction potential between two atoms takes the form that this is the non-relativistic potential, plus the relativistic correction, plus the QED correction, and we will stop at this level. Okay, so let's have a look at this QED, because this is something that you may not know. So this is how looks the QED correction to the ground state potential. And let's see term by term. So, well, this expectation value looks simple. This is just the expectation value of one electron delta, Dirac delta function, so it's okay. So this we know how to get. This is two electron delta function. This is also something that we know more or less how to do. There are two absolutely awful terms in this equation. First and this one. Look at this. This is a distribution, principal value of this R12 to minus 3 operator. This is something, you know, and yeah, you see the definition. This is something very, very difficult to estimate. It does not converge with any basis sets, and actually you have to heavily regularize it to get any result that would make sense. But and this is what we call the Araki-Sacher term. Okay, so this is one which is very unpleasant. But there is another quantity which is unpleasant. This is just this log of k, which look very innocent. But if you look at this definition of this log of k, you see that we have the logarithm of the Hamiltonian minus h node. And you know the logarithm of the Hamiltonian, that's a strange operator. Well, what we can do actually, we can plug in here the resolution of identity and then get a sum over states expression for this. But this sum over state expression converges extremely slowly, and actually the contribution from the continuum spectrum of the Hamiltonian is very important. And there is a very nice paper that's I co-author on the lamp shifts in the H2 plus molecule. And if you want to know how to get this very accurately, I strongly suggest that you have a look at this paper. Actually, you have to use two kinds of basis sets. You have to use basis sets with very different length scales well, that's a very difficult problem, and actually this term is known for atoms. So it's known for helium and for lithium. It's not yet known for beryllium, I guess. It's known for H2 plus and for H2. So this is all we know about the beta logarithm. Okay. Suppose that we do all these calculations and that we use very large basis sets, which depend on the electronic distance explicitly and so on. So what do we get? So this is our non-relativistic energy that I repeat. Look at the alpha square, minus 0.5. So this is not minus 0.7, okay? This is minus 0.5. Look at alpha cube. It's not much smaller. It's not much smaller than alpha square. Actually, one would expect that since this is alpha cube, so it's roughly 137 times smaller, that we'll get, this kind of ratio, yeah? No, this is just not even factor of 3. So this third order QED is very important. Well, then we can estimate some other small terms, and we end up with this result. And you see that the most recent result of Frederick Merkt, and look at the last digit, how well theory agrees with experiment. In a sense, that's a pity that there is such a good agreement, because this means that the physics that we know up to alpha cube is sufficient to get this kind of accuracy. We would like to get a disagreement between theory and experiment, because we know that the theory is correct. We are for sure that up to alpha cube, there is no error. And then we would have to think what is missing to get the difference. But such an agreement just shows that, okay, all the terms up to alpha cube were computed correctly, and we are on the safe side. Well, what was nicer was this disagreement with the dissociation energy of D2 that was measured in 2004 by Euler. And you see that this is a substantial disagreement. But then, you know, Frederick Merck did the experiment on D2, and you see that again the agreement between theory and experiment is very good. Okay, so you see that we can do very, very precise calculations on H2, but H2 has only two electrons. So that's one thing. So in a few minutes, I will show what we can do for larger systems. But I would like to mention one thing, because the dissociation energy, that's the energy from the ground vibrational state to the dissociation. Okay? So actually, it's not very sensitive to this part of the potential, so to the attractive long range. And actually, the long-range physics in the interatomic interactions, when we go beyond the Schrödinger picture, gets complicated. And actually, we would very like love that some experimentalists measure levels very close to the dissociation to such a precision to see whether the picture that Casimir and Polder introduced in 1948 is correct or not, because there is no experimental evidence. Okay, so we start the long-range QED. So, and what Casimir and Polder suggested is that the interaction between two atoms A and B, the Hamiltonian is the non-relativistic Hamiltonian of the atom A, of the atom B, the Hamiltonian of the electromagnetic field, and then the interaction. But you see that this interaction between atoms is quite strange, because normally the interaction operator is, you know, you have Coulombic interaction of particle on A with particles on B. But this is, well, they say that the interaction goes through the exchange of photons in the dipolar approximation. So that's how it is derived. And then one can prove that for two atoms in S states, the long-range potential looks like this. You remember that normally that's C6 over R to the 6. C6 is given normally by the integral of alpha square d omega. Here we have some attenuation and an additional polynomial function. So this is how looks the potential in this region. Okay.
Sorry to interrupt. Can I get your cell phone?
My cell phone?
Yeah. It's interfering.
Oh, sorry.
No problem.
Okay, so I will analyze this expression in two limits. One limit will be very large R, and one limit will be small R. Okay? So let's have a look what happens if we have very large distances. So at very, very large distances, you see that the potential is no longer R to the 6, but is R to the minus 7. Okay? So we have, this is not a drastic change, okay, but there is a change in the leading power of the potential. So instead of being R to the minus 7, it is R to the minus 6.
So is this lambda 0, this is the wavelength of the resonant transition?
There is no resonant transition.
You are taking in all square visibilities, you are taking some formation. So, what defines lambda 0?
Oh, the lambda 0 is the characteristic length for the retardation, but I must say that I don't remember the definition. But I can check it.
Well, it should be comparable to the frequency of the wavelength of the principal transition.
But there is no, Andre, there is no transition because we consider the interaction of ground state atoms.
But I mean, in those variabilities that you have, it is a summation over intermediate states.
Yes.
Right? And so that comes out of there, I think. Yeah.
But this is the polarizability at imaginary.
So, well, it is experimentally a relevant question, right? I mean, how far your atoms have to be.
Yes, although the problem is not only getting here, because there are, well, you will see that there are some other theoretical problems. Okay, but now what we can do, actually, we can take the small r expansion of this expression. So let's do it. And after a little of mathematics, the small r expansion gives. It gives the non-relativistic C6 over R to the 6. Perfect. So we are very happy. Then we get some relativistic and QED corrections to the C6 over R to the 6. Then we get C4 over R to the 4. Then we get C3 over R to the 3. I explain these terms. This is Cowan-Griffin, which sums only one electron terms in the Bright-Pauli Hamiltonian. Okay. This is full QED alpha cube. This is full Bright-Pauli alpha square. And this is Araki-Sacher. So you see that by including the retardation, in a sense, at small distances, we already have some parts of the relativistic terms. So the question now is how to do the calculations not to count the terms. Because we do the calculations, okay, so at the minimum we add non-relativistic, alpha square, alpha cube, and so on. But at some point we have to switch on the retardation and switch off the relativity and QED, otherwise we'll have them twice. So this is not elegant from the mathematical point of view, that we have to introduce into the theory a kind of switching point where we stop to use the approach that I showed you before, so explicitly summing non-relativistic, relativistic QED, and just include the retardation. But now that's not only this, because some terms, there are two terms that are not included in this retarded potential. These are small terms, but the question is, are they physical or non-physical? Do they play a role in the calculations or not? So the nice thing would be actually that, but this is probably not possible in a spectroscopic experiment, and to see somehow the switching from this power law, that we know for sure that at some distances this power law will show up, to this power law at large distances. But of course you see that this is all alpha square, alpha cube, so these are very small numbers, so probably it will be very difficult to see it experimentally.
Are there no alpha square and alpha cube terms in the first experiment?
Yeah, they are. I show you actually in this table. So here we analyze the scattering length of H2 and how all these terms contribute. So Born-Oppenheimer 0.4, only C6. Okay? So that's easy. Then we added the diagonal corrections for the mass dependent. You see that it goes from 0.4 to 0.26. C6 changes very little. Then we get the coupling between electronic and nuclear motions. Well, it goes down a little bit. C6 remains the same up to the level that of 4 digits. Then we get the Cowan-Griffin. So the one electron terms from the bright Pauli Hamiltonian. Well, we get 0.68. Well, C6 is changed by 12 times alpha square. Then we get the full bright Pauli, and here the problem starts. Well, we get 0.27 with a C4. But actually, if we get the scattering length from the effective fringe potential theory, then for R to minus 4 potentials, it is defined in a different way than for R to the minus 6 potentials. So visibly, this R to the minus 4 is not physical here. So you see, this model, despite the fact that we took into account all the relativity, is non-physical, because we have something that is spurious. Okay? So let's go further. We take into account all QED effects except for Araki-Sacher.
The same, non-physical.
We take all QED effects. Then Araki-Sacher is R to the minus 3. The scattering length is infinite. So you see, we do an unbelievable effort just to get something that is completely wrong. Okay? And then we take all the bazaar plus the Casimir-Polder interaction, and we reach 0.27, but still we have a small C5 which is unphysical, which comes from the Araki-Sacher. We still have C6, which should be cancelled out, because we should only get C7. So you see that our best model for the long-range interactions, although it's extremely complicated, is not fully correct. It's not fully correct because we still have this term, which shouldn't be there, and C6 should also be cancelled out. Now, question, can we observe things like this experimentally? Probably not. This is, but who knows? I mean, I would never expect that the dissociation energy could be measured up to 10 to the minus 8 wave numbers, so who knows?
Are there actually experimental results for the scattering length? Because I don't think there are many.
No, the scattering length, it's not a quantity that can be measured. I mean, that's a model quantity. It cannot be derived from an experiment.
Well, I remember that, for instance, this hydrogen maser experiments where they measure the frequency shift, and from that you can deduce.
This is a model. This is not. This is a model.
That is
measurement. No, this is not what they measure. It's not the scattering length.
Yeah, okay, but they measure.
They measure a quantity that in a certain.
Can deduce,
in a certain model. This is not an absolute measurement. I mean, there are three kinds of absolute measurements that you can make in quantum mechanics. You can measure the frequency, the energy differences, you can measure the intensities, and you can measure the scattering cross-sections. And these are all only three quantities that come out from the Schrödinger equation. All other quantities, you construct a model based most often on the Born-Oppenheimer approximation, and you get some quantities. But when you have the full Schrödinger equation and you solve it, you can only get these three quantities.
So
one is time independent in the discrete spectrum, one is time dependent for the transition dipole moments, and one is in the continuum. And
that's so the cross section at low temperature is no longer proportional to the
square root. That's correct, yeah. That's,
so if you measure the cross section, you would measure the scattering.
The absolute value of the scattering length.
Right. Yeah, not the sign.
Not the sign.
Uncertainty.
Okay, so what is the lesson coming from this? Is that even if you do very precise calculations, you have to be very careful and have a deeper understanding of of the physics you
want to describe, because
in some cases you can make something very accurate and things get a nonsense. Okay? Oh, okay. So what can we do at intermediate values of z? Well, this is and this is actually something that we use. So these are the pseudo-potentials, and there are at least two very good German groups that actively develop these things. This is Stuttgart and Düsseldorf, and they do a very good job. And actually, if we can also improve what they did. So that's the only way we can do. Actually, the idea is very simple. We think that the pseudo-potential includes all the relativistic terms. We don't know what it actually includes, but we hope so. And then, we use the non-relativistic theory, and we hope that we will get good results, and I will show you that this is indeed the case. But let's go to the challenges. So I told you that there are a few challenges. One is this molecular Gerade and Gerade mixing, and this is through this Fermi contact interaction, which is proportional to the scalar products between the electronic spin and the nuclear spins multiplied by these delta functions. And you will see that this term breaks the GU symmetry. So, and this effect was observed in H2+ by Carrington, and in theory it was described for the first time by Moss from the UK. But this is not something that is very often, and actually there are not, as far as I know, not many observations of this effect. Then the finite size nuclear corrections. Again, we know the Hamiltonian. If we could find the shifts due to this term, then we have access to the expectation value of the square of the nuclear radius. So that's something nice if molecular physicists could derive some quantities that are important for nuclear physics. Then QED at the alpha 4 level. So I just tell you what's the problem. The problem is that all QEDs develop for atoms. And then what people do, they lower the symmetry of the problem. So they just fix one interparticle distance, and they say that this is the Hamiltonian for molecules. And this works somehow for alpha cube, but for alpha to the fourth, this lowering of symmetry leads to integrals that are divergent and that do not cancel out. So there is no good alpha to the fourth model of QED, and my colleague Pachucki, who is an expert in QED, he doesn't know how to solve it. So if he doesn't know, I don't know if somebody else will know. And then we have these long-range strong interactions. Well, so there's an additional contribution to C6 and very precise measurements.
But Rupert, any polarizable system, right, would have in the leading order would have this R to the six, right? It's just that nuclear thing. It's going to be nuclear size. It will be a very small number, right? Because of the nuclear size, 2^6 divided by MeV, something like that, yeah? So MeV squared, in fact, yeah?
Yeah, I agree, but if there is a way to confirm this conjecture, it's certainly not from even the lowest nuclear scattering, because still the energies are of the order of mega electron volts, but from molecular spectroscopy. I don't think that any any nuclear physics experiment will be precise enough to get this power law interaction. But, well, I give you this as I told you, this is not, somebody said that maybe like this. And then what is more interesting, and there's some physics, hopefully, but nobody observed this physics, so it would be good that some experimentalists do it. Well, it's this retardation at large distances. So I explained to you in length two ground state atoms, okay? But then we have the first order resonant interactions of S plus P identical atoms, and this potential is R to minus 3, but it gets some oscillating terms. And personally, I don't like oscillations in the potentials, but maybe this is true. But again, there's no experimental evidence that this is correct. Moreover, if you look at the literature 3 years ago, there was a paper in EPGD that falsified this expression. Well, there was an immediate response from some other people that the derivation is wrong. But you know, the QED derivations are very subtle, so it would be very good to have some experimental evidence whether this gives contribution or not. But there's even something more interesting, because if you have a ground state atom in an S state and an excited S state atom, which are identical, then there is no first order resonant interaction, because there is no multiple transition dipole, but there is a second order. And you see that this is R minus 2. So this is a very drastic power law change from R minus 6 to R minus 2. But it is alpha square. So it's very small. But, well, it has to be considered. I mean, we are just looking at some system for which this could possibly be observed. Okay, and some preliminary results for lithium. So this is the best fit to the experimental data of Bob LeRoy. This is the equilibrium distance for the 7-7 molecule. This is the binding energy, and the data were available for the 6-6 molecule, and this is the difference in the equilibrium distance and the difference in the binding energy. So this reflects mostly the diagonal correction for the nuclear motion. And actually, we have quite a lot of results for the system. I only give you the results for the equilibrium distance. And now, this is, you know, the quantum chemistry kitchen. So the important thing in quantum chemistry is to go in two directions. Why the direction is we increase the size of the one particle basis set. So the number of so-called orbitals, okay? So, this is a double zeta, triple zeta, quadruple zeta, and so on. And plus we add some mid-bond functions, we have to saturate the results with respect to the size of the one particle basis set, okay? And the second direction is that we have to saturate the results with respect to the number of excitations that we include in the wave function, okay? And for this, you use its famous coupled cluster method, and this is single, double, and triple excitations, then quadruple, and so on. But all this can be done. Then we have to add the mass-dependent terms, because lithium is a light system, so the diagonal correction for the nuclear motions will play a role. And then on the top of it, we have to add relativity and QED, and see what we get. So I show you what we get. So CCSDT is complete, and this is the, and we know how to, that the nice thing in the construction of these basis sets is that we know how to extrapolate to the complete basis set limit. So they are not constructed ad hoc, but there is some idea behind, and we can, having these five results, we can extrapolate, and these extrapolations are highly reliable. So you see that if we extrapolate CCSDT, we get this 334.9 versus 333.8. So we have one wave number of difference. Well, for a quantum chemist, one wave number over 300, that's peanuts. That's completely unimportant. But of course, for spectroscopy, this is a big number. So then, and this is already a non-standard calculation. So you don't have this code in any black box packages. Okay. So then we include quadruple excitations, and here I only gave the in the smallest basis the contribution from the quadruple. And the student messed up the inputs for all other bases. I have so much hope to show you. But when he sent me the data, it didn't make sense, and I started to analyze the output. And oh, Jesus. But he's a freshman, so. Okay, but even if this number, we get to see 333.3. Which we compare with 333.8. Well, it's not too bad, we are approaching. Okay? Well, then we add the diagonal correction. The best one is minus 0.1. So we are now at 333.4. So we are still missing 0.4 wave numbers to reproduce the best fit of Bob Leroy. Okay? And of course, there are many sources of this term. So of course, we have to fill out this line, then we have to make couplet clusters, singles, doubles, triples, quadruples, pentuples, and sextuples, and that's doable, but we will not go as far as here, we will probably stop at this level. Then we have to do the relativistic calculation, and that's easy, and then we have to estimate QED, and that's doable. What is nice, actually, because this is something that we can already check, how accurate is our mass-dependent correction. And actually, we get a difference between lithium-6 and lithium-7 on 0.017, and you see that this is within the error bars of the fit of Bob Leroy. So this means that the mass correction is reliable. For the rest, you have to be patient, and I have to check from time to time the inputs of my students. So summarizing lithium, what are the theoretical prospects? CCSDT cube with large basis sets, yes, definitely. CCSDT cube P6, yes, but with small basis sets. Relativistic alpha square with large basis set, yes, but at CCSDT level. QED alpha cube, yes, but with the atomic beta logarithm, no molecular, but the atomic one for H2, it approximated very well the molecular ones, so there is no need to introduce the R dependence in the beta logarithm. So this, and the Araki Sacher, no, I'm sorry, but this is out of scope. And now, what are the possible predictions from such a calculations? So we hope to see, and the data that Kirk presented, well, suggest that there are some molecular Gerade and Gerade mixing between the singlet Gerade and the triplet and Gerade states. So that one thing. And then since he has 600 kilohertz and yesterday he told us that he can reduce to 100 kilohertz. So if so, maybe we can have a direct probe that there is a long range retardation. And I think that my time is over, so actually I will not talk.
We should postpone this until the Friday.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to say, that I will not talk about this nice project which was done entirely with Christiane Koch, who is here, and actually she pushed me hard, but finally something very, very nice came out, but this I skip and I only go to the conclusions. Okay, there are three conclusions that I would like to mention. One is that precise calculations are now feasible for few body systems, and two, with some restrictions to light many body systems. You know how to make difference between the free body system and the few body system and many body system? Check whether you're able to write the anti-symmetrizer, and then you decide that this is few body or many body. In the case of lithium-2, the anti-symmetrizer contains factorial 6 terms. So this is a lot, and this is already a many body system. Okay? For helium-2, it's factorial 4, that's 24 terms. We can survive. But 24 times 5 times 6, that's... So lithium-2 is already a many body system.
Can I quote you as having said that?
So then, there is a conclusion concerning heavier systems. I didn't show you the results for the strontium molecule. I can only be proud that the theory was and is still a step ahead before the experiment of Eberhard Thiemann, which is extremely rare. Usually, Eberhard is one step ahead before. Theory. So this time he even
wants to use the
initial data to construct his spectroscopic potential. And a small advertisement is just that we are working on introducing explicitly correlated basis sets in the many body theory. And I hope that next year there will be a first release of a program which we call COOS. And this will be a general purpose ab initio package for the electronic structure calculations with Slater orbitals and explicitly correlated Slater geminals and Kołosz-Wolniewicz function. And with this, I would like to thank you for your attention.
But with this name, you make sure that it can only run on Polish computers,
Sorry?
With a special character, it can only run on.
I decided to keep the slash L because when I see his citations and he died in 1996 and people still refer to his paper and they keep the slash L, so which means that they know this letter and then I decided to keep it in the name.
But if you run the program, exactly. How do you call it?
Is there any possibility?
And it's not an acronym. And it's not an acronym, an a posteriori acronym cause.
Well, we can think of it, but I would think of an acronym.
No, but you can call it colossi.
Does it mean something very big in Polish?
Koloss, yeah. Koloss, no. Koloss is just a proper name. But if you say koloss, yeah, that's something immense.
Colossal, something else. Yeah.
I have a question.
So how do you see it playing out a measurement, for example, our measurements and this theory to observe this UG mixing? Like, what's a scenario that you see happening?
Yeah, from my point of view, the scenario is very, very simple. Just because, we have to do the tedious work of getting the non-relativistic potential. And actually, for you, this may not be very exciting, but actually nobody did this kind of CCSDT, CCSDTQ, and CCSDTQP6, and so on. And we really want to get an understanding how you know, it goes with the basis and with the amount of the correlation. Okay, and this has to be done. And actually, I don't like to rely on empirical potentials. So I better like to have my own potential and then make even fine tunings to this potential to reproduce perfectly your data. But at least I know what I change. Okay. So that's one thing. The second, and actually, this is the challenge because. There's no challenge in getting relativistic corrections. This is just running what we call finite field calculations with a given method. And For H2, this was 0.7, so here it will be of the same order of magnitude. Suppose that we have a 5% error. We hope to have it smaller, but okay, and the QED, again, there's no major problem because all the integrals, we will have them from the relativistic calculations. The beta logarithm, we will not get the molecular one, but we know the atomic one from very precise calculations by Pachucki. So this is not a problem. And once we have it, and once you understand a little more about your dependence of the hyperfine constant on the distance, and we may have a look at the levels of the G state and U state and see if there is this interaction. But this is an interesting interaction because this is extremely short range. This is a contact type interactions between the G states and the U states.
And at what level do you expect that correction to be significant? In other words, so I guess what I'm asking is, at what level of precision will the non-relativistic potentials reproduce the data and the discrepancy remaining?
You are. Well, actually, for H2, this was estimated to be of the order of 10 to the minus 5 wave numbers. So if your precision, you are slightly more, maybe 5 times 10 to, but of this order, so suppose 10 to the minus 5 wave numbers. So
that's the level at which this correction becomes,
yeah, but you know, in H2, it happens so that there are no really close, because the triplet states does not have bound states, so there is no a direct interaction of two vibrational levels that are close one to the other. Okay, so in fact, of course, the electronic states are also coupled by this term. Mm-hmm. Okay. But this coupling is, of course, important when you have the two levels close together. This is very complicated because when you include the nuclear spin, so you have the triplet sigma U, you have the singlet sigma G, but then you have a lot of hyperfine states. And in fact, in the long range, your two curves split in, I don't remember, 8. So. No, it's not very complicated, provided that, you know.
And so how important is it to know not only the H-state bound levels from a spectroscopic point of view, but how important is it to also know the singlet levels in the same area?
It is important, but I thought that the singlet potential was pretty well known. But I also base my knowledge on Bob Leroy.
Okay.
Because, you know, Bob Leroy, we were competing for some time, and I remember that Bob told me, Robert, you never get such an accuracy for argon H2 as we can get with a fitted potential. And it's true that for the data that was included in the fit, we couldn't. But for some resonances that were not included in the fit, the ab initio potential was better than the empirical one. And since then, we are very good friends.
On that note, should we conclude the discussion? And ask